and join us again for more great conversations. Stay tuned at 7 for Vegan World Radio.
Vegan World Radio, and then Whole Mother at 8. As always, we leave you with a thought to carry onward through the week. It comes from Audrey Hepburn. She said, "To plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow." Take care of each other. Peace.
Just seeing stock footage of healthy cows, I think people just think of avian influenza in like the abstract, like it's just something out there that's happening. But actually seeing sick cows, piles of dead cows, I think really brings it home to a lot of people.
This virus is particularly concerning because it has spread to so many different mammal species. And each time it jumps from animal to animal, it creates a new opportunity for the virus to develop the mutations necessary that make it more easily transmissible between humans.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM and FM HD1.
Nobody thunk it. Nobody knew, no one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary veal. Cows say tongue. He spoke about justice, but nobody stirred. He felt like an outcast, alone in the herd. Cow doll drum. He moved, we must fight, escape or we'll die. Cows gathered around, cause the stakes were so high. Bad cow pun. But then he was captured, stuffed into a crate, loaded onto a truck where he rode to his fate. Cows are bummed. He was a scrawny calf who looked rather woozy. No one suspected he was packing an Uzi. Cows with guns. They came with a needle to stick in his thigh. He kicked for the groin. He pissed in their eye. Cow well hung. Knocked over a tractor and ran for the door. 6 gallons of gas flowed out on the floor. Run, cows, run. He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up on the hay. We are free-roving bovines. We run free today.
We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high.
We will run free. And we will fight for bovine freedom tonight on this show. Got a fascinating guest joining us tonight on Vegan World Radio. Dr. Crystal Heath is a 2012 UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine graduate. She grew up in a rural agricultural area. She was the vice president for 4-H Club, and she campaigned for the Grand National Rodeo Queen at one time. However, now she's taken a different perspective. She's evolved in the way that she looks at animals, our fellow travelers on this planet, the other species that are so similar to us in their feelings and the way they have eyes to look at the world. They have experiences, and they also carry diseases that can be transmitted to humans. In fact, as we'll hear from her, she's the expert, many of the diseases that we've struggled with, such as COVID, such as influenza, and many, many others, we wouldn't even have if we weren't messing with animals. Dr. Crystal Heath has spent her later career helping homeless animals at the shelters, doing general practice as well as a doctor. And she's done some overseas work to help animals, winning a Jefferson Award for her volunteer work in the island of Fiji. She's working to advance compassionate care for all species on this planet, and her organization, Our Honor, is a nonprofit that supports veterinarians and animal professionals who face bullying and retaliation for having ethical concerns about animals. Dr. Crystal Heath, is that about sum it up, or did I miss anything?
Yeah, no, thank you for that great intro. That's all my stuff right there.
Well, it's been in the news. We appreciate you being on the show because zoonotic disease, of course, has been with us for millennia, but as the human population has ballooned to 6 billion now, and it was, only 100 years ago, it was like 1.5 billion or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're filling the planet up with people. We're changing the land into farms. We're infiltrating like all the forests and jungles and all the places where animals live, and oftentimes killing them and eating them. How is that bringing disease to even those of us who live in cities?
Yeah, I mean, well, we've been farming animals for 7,000 years, but we've never... This is the worst outbreak in history and the worst animal welfare crisis in history. And it's because, you know, we have so many animals that we're farming. And so how does this bring it to people? Well, we get diseases because we're so similar to animals. We share diseases with animals. 75% of all emerging zoonotic diseases come from animals, or all emerging diseases, I should say, come from animals. And we're seeing that now. We frequently have spillover events where diseases in animals then affect other species of animals like human beings. So that's where we're at right now with avian influenza, this really unprecedented avian influenza outbreak that's affected so many different species of mammals across the globe.
So we've been through the whole COVID mess, which we caught from animals. We've been through... in the past, like many different varieties of influenza, including the one early in the 1900s that killed how many people? Do you remember off the top of your head?
Oh my gosh.
The pandemic.
50 million? I don't remember exactly. I should look it up.
So some flus are worse than others, right? So like that particular one broke out, what was it, like 1914? And
yeah.
Something
around
like that.
The First World War. 1918.
1918, okay.
Killed between 17 million and 100 million people worldwide. I guess we don't have good numbers on that, but yeah.
And even now, we get new varieties of the flu every year, and particularly for the elderly and the vulnerable, a lot of them are taken out by the flu, right? Even just the flus that develop, you know, in years where it's not considered like a horrible flu. But why?
The regular seasonal flu, yeah.
Yeah. So what is bird flu? Why do they call it bird flu? And what's the deal with all these different kinds of flu? Like what is going on with this?
Well, yeah, flu viruses mutate quite readily the way they are. And this new avian influenza outbreak started in China, came over here through just migratory birds, and led to this outbreak among commercial poultry flocks here in the United States. And our country was really hit more harder than any other country in the United, or any other country in the world. And we've lost 114 million birds because of it. And it's spread to a variety of different mammal species. So it's been really quite devastating. And now most recently it's infected dairy cows and has jumped from dairy cow workers and poultry workers, or jumped from dairies and poultry birds to human workers. So it's quite frightening. And now we're approaching the regular flu season. I mean, this virus is called H5N1. The regular flu virus might be something different, but we're worried that if the seasonal flu virus infected somebody and then that person was infected with H5N1, that would create the perfect environment for the virus to reassort and potentially cause a virus of pandemic potential. Right now, the virus hasn't been able to spread between human beings yet, but just one mutation they're now finding might lead to a virus of pandemic potential.
When you say we've lost so many millions of birds, like in general in our culture, you know, we talk so euphemistically about what we do to animals, but hey, they just wandered off. Where did they go? These animals were culled, right? Like they were systematically killed, which if you're living in one of those sheds where there's thousands of chickens when they're all like stacked on top of each other and the ones underneath are getting pooped on all day long and they never see the light of day and they turn the lights off and on so that they in such a way that the animals think the day is shorter than it is so they can accelerate their growth and maybe having your head cut off or getting tossed in the grinder is better than life in one of those sheds, I guess, but is it something about the way that we confine these millions? Actually, when we're talking about chickens, it's in the billions, isn't it, of chickens that are on farms?
Well, 10 billion chickens are slaughtered every year in the United States. And when you have thousands and even millions of birds confined in these facilities, genetically similar, highly stressed animals, you create the perfect environment for a virus of pandemic potential to flourish in these situations. So we may have been farming animals for 7,000 years, but we've never been farming them like this. And this is what has led to this unprecedented virus. And what happens when they're infected? Yeah, they can die, but we end up depopulating them, which is a euphemism for mass extermination. And there's no humane way to do this, of course. And so we've resorted to sealing up buildings, pumping in heat, and waiting for the birds to die smothering them with foam. And all of these methods are methods that are approved by the American Veterinary Medical Association, which many of us are opposed to. More than 2,000 veterinarians have signed on to have the AVMA reclassify this method of mass extermination known as ventilation shutdown, where they are killed via heat stroke, to be reclassified as not recommended. And reclassifying it would mean that these large companies would no longer get bailouts for the loss of their birds when their birds are killed this way.
Well, then, I mean, this seems like the experience of dying that way, it seems like cruelty. Like, is that covered under some kind of anti-animal cruelty law or?
You know, the thing is, farmed animals are exempt from a lot of animal cruelty laws. If it's considered to be routine farm animal practice, then it's fine under our law. There are some interesting laws in various states, you know, where you're supposed to provide your animals with fresh circulating air. So this would seem to be in violation of that if you're sealing up the barns and not letting fresh air in. I think a lot of the farms rely on the AVMA guidelines to say, hey, we're just following what the vets say is okay. This is humane according to the vets. And that's might be how they would get around those sorts of things. But yeah, if this was done to a dog, if somebody wanted to kill their dog by locking them in a hot car, that would be considered animal cruelty. But it's not when it's birds raised for meat on a factory farm.
So we know that pigs also are kept in these intense farming operations, whatever they call them, animal...
CAFOs, combined animal feeding operations,
like some kind of euphemistic handle on this, like stuffing as many animals as we possibly can in as small a space as possible so that you get the maximum number of meat coming out the other end. But in between, there's all these individuals that are living these horrific lives and experiencing like that as their whole world, their whole experience of being on this earth. How do pigs enter into this issue? Because I know in the past the media has talked about swine flu, and like how is swine flu different from bird flu, or like what's the relationship?
Yeah, a couple of years ago we had an H1N1 swine flu outbreak, and you know pigs are very similar to humans, so we often share influenza viruses back and forth with pigs. So, there's frequently outbreaks at county fairs where people are interacting with pigs at county fairs. There'll be little flu outbreaks. But now recently with this avian influenza outbreak, H5N1, this is the first time a pig has been infected with that particular virus, which happened up in Oregon. And that was particularly alarming because if the virus was able to mutate to attach to the receptors in pigs and birds, then it could more easily infect human beings. So that shows that it's gained more mammalian adaptations. It's better adapted to mammals. And so that would lead to potentially humans becoming more susceptible even to the virus. Pigs are these mixing vessels is what they say, which creates these influenza viruses that are more susceptible to humans.
So we've created the situation where there's a kajillion humans, even more animals in these intense farms. Every single one of them is potentially a petri dish for breeding a new form of this disease. What do you think in the long run is likely to happen?
I mean, we're just in an ever-escalating arms race against nature. I mean, some people are calling for vaccines now for avian influenza, but the influenza viruses mutate quite readily. And if it's not influenza, it's corona or something else that's going to get us. So it's just, you know, a matter of time before some horrifying disease affects all the animals, all the people. And so this really just threatens our food security, even if you don't care about animals. Like if we have become so dependent on animal protein, we eat twice as much animal protein as we did a century ago. We're really putting our food security at risk, as well as public health too, with the way that we're raising these animals for food.
So would an alternative be switching to different kinds of protein?
Absolutely. Yes. We need to.
Like, do we need to eat animals to live? Like, is it necessary? Like...
I don't think it's necessary. But a lot of people have a hard time getting all the nutrients they need on a animal-free diet, just because the system has been set up in that way. The animal-based protein industry has made it so difficult for people to avoid these products. You can't just go to McDonald's and get a high-protein, animal-free food diet. You can't just go to get a Happy Meal for your kids that's animal-free. I mean, milk is the best. Cow's milk is the best options on the McDonald's menu. So we got to change that. We got to say, McDonald's, you got to have boared cow milk or soy milk for the kids. You got to have animal-free, you know, meals, healthy animal-free meals. And we have to increase accessibility to those things too. We're subsidizing the animal-based protein industry. You know, $38 billion a year goes to it. 73% of dairy revenues come from some form of subsidy. So we need to redirect those funds to support animal-free food production and access to animal-free foods so that everybody can eat in alignment with their values, which they currently can't because the industry has denied us that choice.
So we've got the farm bill paying, essentially buying part of your hamburger for you and buying part of your chicken for you. And yet if you want to go get the Beyond Burger or Impossible or kind of veggie burger, many of which are also high protein and delicious, you're going to pay the full price, right? Like the government's not kicking in on that.
Absolutely. And if you want to grab some quick veggies or fruits at the grocery store, I mean, those little prepackaged fruit bowls cost like $8 when they really should cost, you know, a dollar. That should be something that anybody can grab, a quick, easy, healthy meal. And right now people can't. And the industry always says, oh, the vegans are trying to take away your choices, when really it's them who've taken away our choices and we're forced to pay them whether we buy their products or not. So I think as animal advocates, we really have to shift that narrative and show the world how they're deflecting with this message that vegans are trying to take away our choices, and really show how that industry has taken away our choices.
Yeah, vegans are going to take away your hamburgers. But really, it's, like you say, like it's more like we're being forced into a meat and dairy world. And I've noticed that like in Europe and other places I've been, that they don't put milk in every single thing. And the vegetables, fruit and veg is a lot cheaper in Europe.
Yeah.
And the vegetarian options are also a lot cheaper compared to here.
And absolutely. Yeah. And all those subsidies, they don't actually lower food costs. They end up just kind of going to the executives so that Tyson's CEO can make $29 million a year while their company gets $29 million in bailouts for bird flu. Like it's, people think that, oh no, we're keeping the price of food low with all these subsidies, but we're absolutely not.
Yeah. And all the while the, all this money is going to these oligopoly corporations like Kroger as well. Like we're still seeing grocery prices going up now, even though theoretically in general inflation in the economy is said to have leveled off. We're still seeing fast food prices going up on the whole. And so, and many people reference like the price of eggs as being a reason why they felt like President Biden wasn't doing a good job economically. And it did seem like a disconnect to me when the Democrats kept saying like, hey, everything's great, inflation's over, and yet I go to Kroger, my groceries still cost me more every single time. So it's amazing to me how few people have considered the effect that culling all of these chickens for bird flu, and as well as like the oligopolies that the grocery stores operate, and the very few companies that apparently you could tell us more about this, that I've heard there's very few companies that control meat production and just the farm industrial complex in general. Like there's a bigger picture there, but the Republicans are willing to lie and try to dump that all on Biden, like somehow like it's all his fault, and you know, bird flu and like the war in the Ukraine, and you know, none of that is a factor. It's just pure Democratic incompetence. And all the while, this hustle on the part of these companies to make so much money off of our backs. And at the same time, as you say, like not making it convenient to be vegan, vegetarian. And so it's off the backs of the working class. It's also off the backs of animals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Cal-Maine Foods was implicated in a price fixing scheme. They, you know, decreased the supply of eggs so that the price would go up. And then they, a few years later, just got this $44 million in bailouts for bird flu while their stock price increased 100% over the past year and their revenues increased 700% and their CEO took home $1 million.
Oh, like geez.
It's kind of ridiculous, the corruption. And yeah, like there's just a few main companies that control the supply of food, and you know, Cargill, your JBS, your Tyson, Smithfield, these huge companies that are controlling the supply of meat. Cargill makes money on meat and the feed for animals, and pretty much everything in your pantry, even if you're vegan, Cargill had its hands on it. And this is a company that's the largest private corporation in the world. They have it's a family of 21 billionaires. And this they control our food, and you control the food and you control the people. And it seems like no matter who's in office, Republican or Democrat, the animal agriculture industry will make sure their interests are protected. So it's really concerning when these large corporations are in control of our food supply.
Well, is there any hope for us as a culture to make more rational choices about our food, or like what would that look like?
Well, I have a couple of different ideas about this. And I think one thing we have to do is just tell businesses in general, like, look, we're in this ever escalating arms race against nature with the way that we are raising animals for food. You would be wise to remove animal ingredients from your products because the price is fluctuating, it's a risk. And by doing that and replacing these animal ingredients with other ingredients, you expand your markets so you can reach more customers. So it's a good business decision to do that. Of course, that's a very neoliberal solution to this, of course. I think also just talking about the social justice issues of it, like, and the idea that we have taken away the rights of other animals on this planet. And when we take away the rights of other animals, that affects our health too. And when we have this belief that we can exploit and oppress those with less power than us, that leads to all sorts of different problems in the world. But I also think, you know, if we don't make the conscious choice for ourselves, like, nature is going to make it for us. So we can decide to make a change now and shift our publicly funded investments away from animal-based protein and towards animal-free methods of food production. That would help our nation's security, our national security, our food security. We could be bold leaders in the future of the world if we support animal-free methods of food production. Like, we no longer need to produce protein from cow's milk. We can make cow's milk, straight cow's milk, with precision fermentation. Why aren't we doing that? And why aren't we being leaders in that as a nation? And I think that's the direction we should go in. But of course, the problem is, it's also the pharmaceutical companies, because if we were to decrease the number of slaughter-bound animals, that would decrease the number of vaccines and antibiotics and other medications that go to these animals. So that would threaten pharmaceutical company profits too. So it's all interconnected. It would affect feed grain prices and feed grain profits too. So, you know, they're always looking to upsell these grain calories to animal protein because they can make more money off of it. But this is just a huge problem, and it can't go on like this. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think a start would be getting veterinarians on board, because we are sort of the moral authority in this field. Politicians listen to us, policymakers listen to us. And if we can get veterinarians to say, yes, we need to scale down animal agriculture, and get a group of us together, change the AVMA, we can make huge changes in our food system. It will stop, you know, just supporting these industrial systems, and we'll be able to put more animal protection legislation in place. And I think that's really important. It's right now, it's veterinarians usually killing these animal protection, new animal protection legislation that comes forward. Like the AVMA is trying to overturn Prop 12 with the Farm Bill. You know, they supported a section in there that would overturn Prop 12.
This is in California.
So change this. Yeah. I don't know if you know, like, Prop 12.
Like, very vaguely, can you remind us what that was?
Yeah, it passed with 63% of the vote in California. And it basically is a law that says that the flesh from pigs whose mothers were kept in cages that were too small could not be sold in California. So it expands the size of the cage that these mothers are kept in. Right now, they're kept in gestation crates, 2.5 by 7 foot pens where they can't even turn around. And so this law would have made that larger if their meat was to be sold in California. And it only affected, like, whole meat. It wasn't even on all the meat. So this law passed, but then the National Pork Producers Council, the pork industry in general, fought it all the way to the Supreme Court. Even the Biden administration sent in an amicus brief to overturn Prop 12. But luckily the Supreme Court upheld it, but now in the Farm Bill, they're trying to insert language that would overturn Prop 12 and any animal protection law that would affect the sale of meat in various jurisdictions. So that's really concerning. And the American Veterinary Medical Association supports that sort of language. So we really need to change that as veterinarians, and we have the power to.
Well, do you feel like most veterinarians have this cold-hearted approach to animals where it doesn't matter what happens to them? Or do you feel like it's just certain veterinarians that are doing this? Or?
Yeah, the vast majority of veterinarians are very compassionate people, but they just don't keep up on what's going on in the news. And they kind of defer to their farm animal colleagues in these areas. And, you know, I think a lot of people go into farm animal medicine because they're compassionate too. And, but they're just led to believe that things have to be this way and that any move towards animal protection is a threat and a slippery slope that would lead to all sorts of horrifying things. And they've just been conditioned to believe this way because of the culture of the veterinary profession. But things are changing. You know, there was a recent poll, only 1.1% of veterinarians surveyed believed that ventilation shutdown, where they seal up barns, pump in heat and steam, and wait for the animals to die. Only 1.1% believe that that was ethical and humane.
And that's good.
I have a feeling like that 1.1% is basically in AVMA leadership supporting these sorts of things. So I'm just pushing for a new generation of vets to take over. But until then, we have to join together and advocate and make change. But right now, a lot of veterinarians are just so busy with their day-to-day jobs and the stress of that. They just don't have time to take on these things, which is why I started Our Honor, so we could do a lot of that work. And I know a lot of vets who will sign on to whatever we want to do, but they just don't have time to do the activism themselves.
Well, I understand that vets are being squeezed all over the place with the high cost of school, student loans, and then you've got the insurance and the rents are crazy. And then I understand that the number of vets are being bought out by, and vet services like blood testing and stuff has been bought out by these kind of cutthroat companies that consolidate and raise prices.
So, absolutely. Private equity. So the CEOs can make more and more money while, you know, the vet staff doesn't see a cut of it. And people who have animals and bring animals to the vet have to pay the price.
Man, when are we going to break out of this cycle of like the hustle of like,
I mean, especially,
I mean, the way that we've got, the way that we got here, I mean, one time most people lived on the farm, they ate a little meat, but they ate mostly vegetables. And then gradually people have eaten more and more meat, if you look at cookbooks or just, you know, food culture in general. And then now, even though we have record numbers of vegans and vegetarians who eat no meat, the other people are eating more meat than ever. It's people that eat only meat. They've convinced themselves that anything that's not meat is almost like food poison somehow. Because, oh, it's carbohydrates. It's hard to understand, like how do we get out of this spiraling cycle? I guess it pays well to be a sellout, whether you're a veterinarian or a congressperson voting for the farm bill. How do good people, well-intentioned people, rise above? And I think that I'm kind of setting you up for, because I think that you are on a bit of a crusade, but you have an organization that you're working on to get veterinarians to speak out.
So Our Honor, we support animal professionals working to create more ethical systems. And we believe that the way to change is by changing the veterinary profession and targeting whose ideas we change. Because right now there is this culture war going on around meat. It's like the vegans and the progressives are trying to take away our ability to eat meat. And, you know, all these bros on, you know, on the podcast are all talking about how important it is to eat meat. And, you know, also just these outbreaks of E. coli and carrots, it's due to animal agriculture, of course, but now people are scared to eat carrots because of the E. coli and
the
onion
poop
E. coli
on it,
outbreak
right?
too. What?
It's because they put animal poop on the crops, right?
Is that exactly. Yeah, it's the contaminated from animal agriculture and poop. But we believe that if we change the veterinary profession, we'll be able to lead to change, real systemic change in the way that we fund our food system. And also public health officials too. They are outraged about our handling of avian influenza, the lack of testing, the way that producers can bully my colleagues, veterinarians, so that we don't push for testing. Thankfully, now the USDA is mandating bulk milk tank testing nationwide. So hopefully we'll get a handle on just how widespread this outbreak is. But I think a lot of doctors, public health officials, epidemiologists are all looking at this going, whoa, the way that we raise animals for food is creating just the perfect environment for these outbreaks to continue to happen. And this is costing us so much and risking our public health. So I think hopefully the experts will rise up, but there's also on the other side, a lot of people saying H5N1 isn't real. It's all just a conspiracy to take away our our meat and to disrupt our food system and all of that. So it's really disturbing right now how much confusion there is around all of this. But I think the only thing we can do is keep talking and keep sharing our story and showing the evidence and trying to decrease this polarization and start a dialogue with people who you might disagree with. I think right now we live in this world where if you disagree with somebody, you just don't talk to them anymore. You block them on social media. You know, they're out of your family. And we just create these bubbles of like-minded people, which that doesn't lead to any change. If we're not able to influence people outside of our bubble, we're not going to lead to any sort of systemic change. So talking in ways that leads to more understanding and decreases polarization and stick to the evidence and avoiding sensationalized language and polarizing language, I think will really help.
Absolutely. Although I'm probably very guilty of the polarizing language, but on this show, because I feel like maybe it's the vegan perspective is most vegans are so polite and so nice and soft pedal everything. It's like, I remember in the 90s when they said that animal rights was like the number one terrorist threat. And I was like, what's the threat? Like, we're going to be like too nice to you or something? Like, so I don't know. I guess maybe the one thing I would differ with you a little bit is maybe sometimes I think I'd like to see vegans more out and proud, but maybe I'm wrong. And I definitely respect that the work that you're doing within the professional sphere and the necessity of keeping things professional and this certainly plenty of evidence for what you're arguing for without going as far as like I would be inclined to go about animal rights and treatment of animals. So
yeah, I mean I agree with you. I think vegans do need to talk. We need to say our piece more. I think telling people to go vegan isn't the best message, because I think some people, no matter what, even if they agree with you, they lack the self-discipline to change their diet in the face of billions of dollars in marketing and the social pressure. But I think, you know, explaining to people why you're vegan and telling and having them join in your campaigns, like even if you eat meat, like I still want you to join us in trying to redirect subsidies away from animal agriculture and towards animal-free methods of food production. And like, let's advocate for companies to take out animal ingredients from their products and replace them with animal-free ingredients. Like, even if somebody isn't vegan, we can still have them join in for that cause.
Absolutely. And I think people know in their hearts, you know, they find excuses to explain it away. But I think people know in their hearts, especially when they're kids, like they look at an animal, like you can see the feelings on their face. You can see a happy dog, a sad dog. You can see a happy pig. You know what a happy animal looks like. You know what an animal that's like in fear for its life looks like. Like, you know, we don't have to like try that hard to empathize with animals. So we do have to try hard not to empathize with animals. So I feel like if people would just go back to their true inclinations. But I get what you're saying, that the way it is today in the United States, it is easier in Europe, but in the United States, parts of Europe. But it is sometimes inconvenient. I mean, like, not eating animals is simply eating something else that's not an animal. But, you know, like you say, sometimes it's kind of hard to find. Or you have to look a little harder or plan or bring food with you. Or
lot of people, like, still, you could tell them to your blue in the face that you can live healthy on a vegan diet. But they don't believe that. And, you know, nothing you say is going to make them believe that. You can show that you're healthy and fit and everything. But we really have to, I don't know how to convince people, if they don't believe it. They always think, oh, you might be able to live healthy on a vegan diet, but I can't for whatever reason.
Oh, well, we're also good at like, past that. Yeah, we're also good at justifying ourselves, like justifying whatever we want to do, even like deep down if we kind of know that it's justification. And it's funny how the excuses are different in different places, like and change over time. Like they used to say, like, oh, well, you don't get complete proteins if you don't eat meat. Okay, we've definitely found that's not true. And then they were like, oh, okay, well, there's not adequate nutrition in vegan. And then science has proved that's not true. The British Health Authority and many other organizations have said that vegan diet has everything that you need as long as you eat a variety of foods. And so then they just switch to another excuse. Or you talk to people from India that they always, there's one they always pull out that's like a different one that you never hear here. And it's like, they're clearly excuses if it's always something.
Yeah.
But I digress because I really want to hear more of your expertise about zoonotic disease. So as a doctor and someone that studied this in detail, is it all right if we talk a little bit about the whole COVID debacle and like your take on what happened with that? Is that something that you've looked at?
You know, I, depending on what you're going to ask, I don't know if I know a whole lot about the COVID debacle, but I can, you know, let me know what's your question related to that, like where it came from. I think we still don't know really.
Right. That's my understanding too, is that there's no definitive scientific answer of like what the source was. But I do understand that there's some data where they swabbed the wet, so-called wet market, like wet is in like blood and pus and stuff, because you could pick out a live animal and they'd slaughter it right there in front of you. In China, it just happened to be like suspiciously close to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. But they went and scientists went and swabbed immediately after the outbreak started, swabbed the different parts of that wet market. And they did find a whole lot of that virus around one of the sellers who was selling a species called the raccoon dog. So although we don't know that that's the source, like there's evidence that points to that from what I understand.
I mean, it's likely that, you know, any emerging disease comes from animals and then infected humans. Like that's just very common. And especially when you're in a situation where you're exploiting animals like a wet market, you know, a bunch of different species, that creates the perfect environment for a virus to bounce around the different species and develop mutations, and then develop the mutations necessary for it to infect humans. And this is just something that we see over and over and over again. And COVID, you know, led to just this worldwide outbreak that was devastating. But we have all sorts of coronaviruses all around everywhere.
Well, yeah, and I know we're getting more into the murkiness of not settled science or certain science, but I've heard this theories that some of the other coronaviruses that are now just endemic cold viruses, that one of them may have jumped from, I believe it was in the 1960s, they think that one may have jumped from cows. And they think that possibly there was a pandemic in the 1890s that, for example, killed like the guy that was going to be the King of England and quite a few other people. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that might have been a coronavirus that people got from horses, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. We had MERS and SARS and all of these other coronaviruses throughout history. Anytime, and I don't want people to be scared of animals. Like that's not the goal here. It's just that, you know, our interaction with animals, especially when we are exploiting them, it seems like just nature has a way of retaliating. When you're not in alignment with nature, you end up getting these diseases. I mean, we evolved the ability to empathize with other animals about 100,000 years ago. And it seems like whenever we betray our natural instincts to empathize with other animals, it leads to harm for us, our own species. So even from a selfish perspective, it's probably a good idea to consider the interests of other species. And maybe we evolved that ability to empathize for a reason. So, and not just to make us better hunters, but maybe to protect ourselves.
Yeah, we can think about the Native Americans like speaking to the animal spirits, and you know, and they were in a different circumstance than us, because you know that for them maybe it was more of a matter of survival, you know, for us, it's a matter of like, which freezer do you pull the food from? There's a freezer right there that has healthy vegan food. You just pull it out of there. You don't have to pull it out of the meat section.
Yeah.
But, but as far as getting back to the zoonotic diseases, what do you think about the origin of HIV? Like, what's known about that?
Oh gosh, that's another one that's like murky, and we don't quite know what happened there, but you know, seems to come from primates and infected humans somehow. And now that's another scenario where, and then we're doing a whole bunch of testing in primates to try to cure it, but primates react differently than we do, and much like the polio vaccine, it's like the animal researchers always say, "Oh well, we developed the cure for polio thanks to primate research," but really, that delayed our polio vaccine for quite some time because primates don't quite get polio and respond to polio the way that humans do. And really, it was experimenting on orphan children in orphanages that led to our advancements in polio treatment. And I don't think anybody is advocating for continuing to exploit orphan children in order to get medical advances. So.
Oh, that's interesting. So, And it is in the past, a lot more research was done on animals than is done now, right? Would you say there's in general a trend away from animal research because it's been found to be so unreliable?
That's, you know, I wonder what the numbers are. I have a feeling we are doing more animal research than we did in the past.
Okay, great.
Because we have more scientists. There's like more of a system. And I actually went to one research talk recently where they were discussing the replicability crisis, because it's so difficult to replicate studies. You do one study and you come up with a certain data set and then you repeat it. It's completely different because you're doing experiments on stressed little animals, but their solution to this isn't to like, let's not test on animals anymore. It's to, oh, we have to increase the number of animals. We adhered to the three R's too much. And the three R's, if you don't know, are replace, refine, and reduce the number of animals in experimentation. So they're like, we adhered to the three R's. We reduced the numbers too much. That has led to the replicability crisis. So we need to increase the number of animals so that all those animals' lives aren't lost. For, you know, it would be horrifying if we did a study and none of their lives mattered because it wasn't replicatable. So it's frustrating, to say the least.
And I mean, even if stuff is coming out of that, I mean, it's so cold-hearted, because I understand lab animals are also, just like farm animals, they're also exempted from the cruelty laws, right?
Yeah, in many ways, especially if you can pretty much do anything to them, as long as you say, well, you need to do this for the research. Like, yeah, you're supposed to use pain control and certain size cages and all of that. But if the research protocol demands that you do this surgery without pain medication for some reason, well, then they have to do it. So yeah, in a lot of ways, they get around all of those animal cruelty laws.
And I've always thought this is, it's just, I mean, I know this is a fraught issue, but it just seems like if we want to do research and we truly want to find out like what happens, like how diseases spread and all the stuff that's being researched, like maybe we should be brave enough to volunteer ourselves, to put ourselves at risk for that. But I know it's,
yeah.
But like you say, if it ends up being the orphans or people in prison or like disadvantaged groups, then that's not acceptable either. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, there's this great book called The Occasional Human Sacrifice by Carl Elliott. And it's one of the most profound books I've ever read. And I recommend it to everybody, but it's all about the problems with human experimentation. I do agree. Like, I want to be experimented on. I think that's the future, but you have to do it in an ethical way, informed consent, and all of these things. And he goes through a bunch of studies where there was a problem, and it wasn't because there's an inherent problem with human experimentation. It's because of the systems in place, the hierarchy, the bullying and retaliation of whistleblowers, and not listening to people who voice concerns. And so even if we're having issues in human experimentation, of course we're going to have issues in animal experimentation where our patients don't even have any rights. I mean, if all of these issues happen in humans, when humans have rights and protections, like, you can only imagine the atrocities that happen to animals. But I think, you know, there is a future that is animal-free experimentation or experimentation on animals for their benefit. Like, you have a dog that you're taking care of and the dog has a rare disease or something, and we develop a treatment for it. We can do that treatment in a clinical setting and monitor the dog, and you are their advocate. You're not doing experimentation in a lab where they're stuck in a cage, you know, real world stuff. And if we are spending $24 billion a year on animal experimentation right now,
damn, really?
Developing things where, like, the animals, you know, current animals don't even have access to medical care. So what if we expanded access to medical care, gave increased access to diagnostics and other things instead of just funding experiments on animals in cages? We might find a lot more than we're finding now.
Yeah, that reminds me of during the AIDS crisis, before they had effective drugs, the activists that were insisting on, like, hey, like, stop giving these drugs to animals. Let's go ahead and test them on us. If there's a chance, we're going to die. And when it seems like when they finally did that, like, famously with AZT and some of the other drugs, that's when they really started to make progress, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a fascinating time, too. I was reading up about that, and it's funny, the sort of infighting within the AIDS community around that time. And, you know, it very reminiscent of the animal rights movement, where, like, one side, like the pro-testing side, you know, and the anti-testing side, and they're calling each other murderers and stuff. And it's like, oh yeah.
Wow. Do you have a sense of, like, which was the predominant view, or?
No, I don't really have a sense, but it led to a lot of fracturing within the activist community around that issue in particular. And there were so many different testing models and various disagreements about all sorts of ways to go about these things. But it always leads to, like, calling your fellow activists murderers or out to harm the movement or whatever. We need to be able to discuss these things in a more rational manner and not assume that the other side is out to cause harm and, you know, destruction. So.
Well, do you think that all this could connect if we had an ethos of a genuine empathy for each other and for animals, ethos of genuine compassion in this culture? Do you think that we would operate differently than we do now, where we have this ethos of, like, screw you, I'm going to get mine, get out of my way?
Yeah, I mean, we just have this idea of hierarchies, and I think we need to abolish all beliefs in hierarchies. I mean, we do have, you know, some vegans believe that they're morally superior to people who eat meat. And I think we have to recognize that if we were them, lived their life, had their experiences, we would be making the same choices that they're making. That doesn't mean that we can't be a countervailing force and, like, try to influence them and talk to them, but we are not morally superior to them. And we've got to dismantle that idea. And then if we dismantle that idea, then let's also dismantle the idea that humans are inherently better than other animals and more deserving of rights and protections than others. And we have a right to exploit other species for profit, because, as we've talked about, anytime we believe that leads to more disease and harm for us. So it's ultimately kind of selfish to advocate for ending these ideas of hierarchies and other species.
Okay, I definitely see what you're saying, but I mean, what for the animal that's going down the slaughterhouse line and he's seeing, he's seeing the cows in front of him getting, like, a bullet or a bolt fired by a gun-like object, like, basically, like, a huge bullet to the brain. Like, does he care what whether people think that they're better than anyone else? Or, like, I mean, if someone eats meat, that has concrete consequences for animals.
Well, even if, like, I don't eat meat, but I'm still funding that industry. So We're all implicated in the destruction of animals, whether we eat them or not. Of course, I will, you know, encourage people to, you don't have to eat meat, but under the current systems, you know, fluctuating demand does not hurt the meat industry, and we have to change that. And I think ultimately it's better for the animals if we're able to meet each other and talk about these things without being polarized and hierarchical in our thinking about these things. And once we do that, we'll be able to also extend that to the animals, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. Because once upon a time, like PETA, people for the ethical treatment of animals, I remember in the 80s and the 90s, they used to talk about how the legislation they passed was often passed in a very bipartisan way. Mm-hmm. And they were often surprised that some of the people that were the very avid defenders of animals weren't always necessarily on the left.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of groups are now targeting more conservative mindset. White coat waste isn't a great one that sort of uses more conservative messaging. And Matthew Scully, a speechwriter for the Bush administration, wrote the book Dominion, which I highly recommend. It's a bipartisan issue for sure.
Yes, and speaking of Dominion, I mean, I wish that we could somehow get people who believe in the compassion and the universal love of Christ to see the hints that remain in Christianity of the original. I think probably we can't know for sure, but the Jesus took action against animal sacrifice. He said, "Hey guys, stop sacrificing animals. I'm going to be sacrificed. You don't need to do that anymore." Like, that was a huge change in the religion that he created. And he compared himself to a lamb. And we know that a lot of the early Christians, not the followers of Paul, but the ones that didn't follow Paul, were vegetarians, and they had a conflict with the Pauline Christians over eating meat or not. So, I wish that the people who, take to heart the universal love and like the compassion of Christ, I wish they could return to that idea of compassion and have compassion for the animals as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Have you seen Christspiracy? I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to.
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh.
But we put that on the list. So yeah. In the remaining minutes, we have two more minutes before this interview is over. Is there anything that you particularly wanted to mention tonight? Anything we haven't covered?
Go to ourhonor.org. We have a lot of info on our website. We keep track of the bailout money that these companies get for avian influenza. Jennie-O Turkey Store got $107 million in bailouts for the loss of their birds. There's another outbreak in Meeker, Minnesota, where Jennie-O is right now. There is a big outbreak in Iowa, where Center Fresh Foods was. 4.2 million birds recently. So keep track.
Wait, 4.2 million birds were culled.
For 4.2 million birds. Million. And this facility has been hit multiple times now. And so I would encourage people, if you live near any of these outbreaks, like, go drive by, take pictures, see for yourself, and send any pictures that you have to us at ourhonor.org. We'd love to see them, send them to the media, get more stories about this in the media. It's so important.
Or Dr. Crystal Heath I'm blanking. What's the name of your group? And you just said it.
Our Honor.
Yeah. Our Honor. And your website is?
Ourhonor.org. ourhonor.org.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you being on the show tonight. It's been a fascinating discussion, hopefully food for thought for our listeners out there. Good luck on your work. And
thank you.
All power to y'all.
Thanks so much.
And this has been another episode of Vegan World Radio here live on KPFT Houston on this 9th day of December 2024. Let's hope that a bunch of us don't all die in a bird flu outbreak. That'd be cool. And in the meantime, happy holidays, everybody, whatever holidays y'all celebrate. And remember, there will be a big celebration the day the last slaughterhouse closes. I'll see you there.
Don't eat your friends. Don't eat your friends. and meat. Nature's full of plants to eat.
Don't eat your friends.
Fruit and grains, nuts and seeds give you all your body needs.
Don't